I told you there was a couple times where I had to use my veto power as the team leader. And those were the times where everyone just would get so focused on what they are doing. Like the cameraman gets so focused on what he's doing or recovering his lost drone that he ends up, you know, the search party has to go out for him because he got lost looking for a lost drone. Or Jamie being so determined to get his machines up and running in the middle of a gale force blizzard, that he misses the fact that he's starting to suffer frostbite and so are the team members because everyone's standing around. You know, at those moments, you know, you'd have to say, okay, guys, look, I understand your tunnel vision here, but for the sake of the team, you know, this is what's going to happen now.
Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to this sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of this sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert, and we are back for episode 3 with Jonathan Hayes talking about his expedition across Alaska this past January 2025, paying homage to the 1925 Serum Run with his team of Sepala Siberians and his crew of four people total, cruising across Alaska in the middle of an Alaskan winter. There's a lot of crazy stories there. We've already shared a few of them in our previous episodes. We're dead in the middle of this series. Jonathan, can you share a quick story about the passage from Galena-ish to Unalakleet? What's something that stands out here as you reflect about 6 months after the expedition?
A couple things that stand out to me on that stretch is, other than the schools, we loved, and we can't say this enough, one of the most beautiful things about this expedition was pulling into these villages and the children pouring out and pouring over the dogs. Unlike some breeds, Arctic Spitzbreed dogs are notoriously aggressive. Sepalas are not. They're very amiable dogs. I could just, in every village, doesn't even matter the dog. It's 16 dogs on my team. I'm like, nope, kids, go ahead, have at it. You know, and just seeing the village kids pour over the team, especially, that's kind of bittersweet because of the shutdown of the salmon fisheries on the Yukon River now, a lot of those native villages can no longer support dog teams. So, just being able to share my team with them was great. Caltag had a big potlatch to commemorate the Serum Run, and we were the guest of honor. And that was just really cool. The hospitality in each of these villages was over the top. In addition to the Alaska Railroad Museum's serum box that I was hauling, that also contained letters from the children of Nenana to the children of Nome. In Caltag, I was given a large poster to carry to Unalakleet. Unalakleet had just had a tragedy strike with the basketball teams traveling from Unalakleet to Nome. There was a plane that went down over Norton Sound. And so the village of Unalakleet was mourning that. And so we got to, at first I thought, man, why would you give this to me to give to the town of Unalakleet? You know, just send it in the mail. You know, I'm still thinking in lower 48 standards. And it's like, no. This is actually the fastest way it's going to get to Unalakleet is if I carry it, because no one else is making this trip. And as far as the portage, I would say, until before it's your favorite place in the world, it's somewhere you've never been. And the portage is just magical. It's just magical. And I just can't describe it any other way. And I'm sure the monotony of day after day of being on the Yukon exaggerates the magic of that portage. But, you know, that portage is significant historically, you know, even, you know, before, you know, Russians were using it as a trapping corridor, even before then, the Athabascans and the Eskimo, the Athabascans of the interior and the Eskimo on the coast would use it to both trade with each other and to raid each other. And so that corridor has this really, really rich history. And then you hit Old Woman Cabin, and you know the lore about, you know, Old Woman Cabin, that, you know, she'll curse your trip if you don't leave her a sweet. And so you got to leave leave some candy or some
chocolate. Did you leave candy?
I did.
What did you leave?
I brought an almond Snickers. I love Snickers, and I left her a Snickers there, and I actually took a video of myself putting it there right next to the sign on one of the logs sticking out of the log cabin. And you know, it's crazy that, you know, not only do I know that pass has been used for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. And so, you know, it does have almost that spiritual old woman spirit kind of thing. But that was the first and only place on the expedition where we got this huge, right over the Old Woman Cabin, this huge display of the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights just dancing over our team. So that was really magical, really beautiful. And that was the first time in the expedition that I allowed myself to believe that I was going to finish. I'm a determined person, and I'm going to push and I'm going to make things happen. But I also am aware that there's a lot of things that can go wrong. And my team, let's face it, my team was untested before this to a large degree. And so when we pulled in there and everyone's looking good, 16 dogs out of 16 dogs, and, you know, not a bleeding foot. And I'm just like, yeah, we're going to do this. Like, you know, we're going to make it to Nome. That being said, and this, you said this section brings us to Unalakleet. I'll say this and then I'll wrap up. Old Woman Cabin marks the end of the shelter of the interior and the beginning of the exposure of the gale and sometimes hurricane force winds and the ice of the coast. And that had been the, especially with me having blown out my knee a couple of years earlier and, you know, it being my weak link, that on ice with 16 dogs, you know, it was nagging in the back of my mind. You know, my team had never experienced what we were about to experience. I had never experienced what we were about to go through on the coast. And so there was some anxiety, you know, leading down from Old Woman Cabin heading toward Unalakleet.
We're going to talk about coming into Unalakleet. I know you have a story about that coming up. We're going to hold that and put a feather in the cap, as you will. But let's jump into some of these questions. If you're listening, you probably have figured out the format by now. We're talking about outdoor leadership. We're talking about expedition planning and all that goes into that, team building. And of course, we're showcasing the Sepalus Siberian sled dog, which is an important component of this, not only for the historical aspect, but obviously Jonathan's work with this breed. It's one of his life missions for sure. But let's jump into these, Jonathan. What are some of the biggest challenges you faced during the expedition? I know we talked about in a previous episode weather and overflow and all that. So let's take weather out of this. What about other challenges, team challenges, logistic challenges, gear challenges, those sorts of things? What did you face?
So I'll start with myself. I think one of the biggest challenges was there's a big difference in, as every Iditarod musher knows, there's a big difference in, you know, running out of your kennel every day and then parking your dogs back at their place. And, you know, running them 60 miles and having a day off and running them 60 to 70 miles a day after day after day after day. And there was a lot of the rhythm and the routine. And I'll just go back to, you know, my conversation with Mitch Seavey. You know, when I worked with him and I learned so much from him, you know, he kept reminding me that your Cephalas are different than my Alaskan Huskies. And, you know, what works for my Huskies might not work for your Ceps, and what works for your Ceps might not work for the Huskies. And so I was 2/3 into this expedition, still figuring out what the natural rhythm of my dogs is, because I'd not done anything like this before. So that was a big thing. A big challenge was that. And the other big thing is, in order to make something like this successful, you need great people around you. And I had a team of great men, but when you have great men, you also have a lot of, personality frictions that can arise, and, you know, that kind of thing. And everyone completely a master in their own realm. And navigating that sometimes was difficult. And, you know, getting us all to the finish, still liking each other, because, you know, you're under a lot of stress, you know, and everyone from the cameraman to the snow machiners, you know, Jamie, Jeff, Caleb, you know, everyone's busting their butt, you know, and in some ways, you know, as a musher, you know that, you know, when you pull into a checkpoint or when you pull into a village, that's when your work really begins. Right. So mushing is 90% Zen and 10% pucker factor, right? You know, but when you're not in that 10% pucker factor, most of it, you know, you're enjoying the ride, right? So, you know, in a lot of ways, my team was in a lot of ways working harder than me, because I didn't realize until, you know, sometime we were being interviewed after the expedition and finding out later that my snow machiners that on some days I thought were already in the next village enjoying dinner while I'm mushing were actually, you know, only a mile ahead of me because they, you know, break their sleds out of, you know, of being stuck, go 100 yards and get stuck again, and then go 100 yards and get stuck again. And so oftentimes they were only pulling into the villages, although I hadn't seen them all day, they were pulling into the villages sometimes just an hour or two before me.
All right. Let's talk about risk-taking. How did you balance risk-taking with safety? Not only how do you balance risk-taking with safety, not only on this trip, but in outdoor adventures combined?
In order for it to be an adventure or an expedition, let's be honest, there has to be some level of risk. You know, the Iditarod, there are risks, but they're very mitigated compared to an expedition. You know, you have a fleet of snowmobiler. I was talking to Mark Nordman. I think he said they had 9 24-inch wide track Scandix, you know, out on the trail. And, you know, you have planes going overhead, and you have, you know, reporters, and you've got, you know, veterinarians, and, you know, and it's March, you know, which is really different than January and February. So if there's not any risk, then it's not an expedition. It's not an adventure. That being said, you have to balance that desire for some risk with the well-being of your dogs and your teammates. You don't want to be reckless or careless, you know, with the lives of your teammates or your dogs. So there's a balance there to be had.
In reflecting on this, what was the riskiest thing that you undertook? Was it in this section? Was it getting there to the expedition site itself? What was the riskiest thing that you guys had to deal with?
Yeah, and I know I've said this before, but the villagers were telling us, we don't travel between villages till the second week of February. These trails are not in place, and there's a good reason for it. And not only on an average year is the river not ready for it. But this is not an average year. This is an unprecedented year. And everyone was telling us this. So the conditions were the extreme that we were facing. You know, like I said before, there's a reason why the Iditarods run the first weekend in March rather than, you know, the first week in February or January. It's a completely different animal. So, you know, running a, and it's not always groomed in the Iditarod, you know, but running a groomed trail versus having no trail in front of you, or worse, having, you know, the crust of the snow broken, so your dogs are wading chest deep in snow day after day. You know, they're very different. You know, it's apples and oranges.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with that. As they say, the Iditarod machine, it's almost a relay now from checkpoint to checkpoint. And not to say it's easy by any stretch, but it is a little easier to travel on this machine than it is on your own. I'm sure you would agree.
Yes. But and you know, to travel, again, there are differences. And so, yes, I think it is easier to run the Iditarod in March than it would be to run this expedition in January and February. That's what makes it an expedition. It's what makes it an adventure. That said, there are, as you know, really difficult things to the Iditarod that I didn't have to face. Like, I don't have time restraints. I don't have, you know, competitive exclusion clauses and, you know, all of those things that, that an Iditarod musher has pushing on them. You know, the massive, we had sleep deprivation, but nothing like an Iditarod musher has to deal with. So it's just a different animal.
So, a dog question here. How does the dog's lineage influence their performance? We talked a little bit about this in our last episode. How does this, their performance, is it impacted by its lineage during this trip?
Yeah. Every musher is going to brag on their dogs, right? And there are things that intellectually and as a biologist that I'm putting in air quotes, knew about my dogs, because they're a true Arctic Spitz breed traditional dog. But I had not put those things that I quote knew to the test until this expedition. And 16 of 16 dogs marched into Nome after 700 plus miles and could have turned around and done the same thing on the way back. I should have done the math before you asked me the question, but out of 16 dogs times 4 paws each dog, times the number of days that we were out there, I used a total of about 16, somewhere between 16 and 20 booties while I was out there. I had a, you know, in an Iditarod, you have a very much preventative, and it's because you're running so many, they're running so many miles in a day, right? They're doing what I'm doing in 2 days. They're doing it in a day. So that's going to wear down the feet faster, and it's going to give their dog's feet less time to recover. I understand that. But the fact remains that this traditional Arctic Spitz breed dog was actually, in my estimation, hindered by the coats that I was putting on them. And we can get into that when we get to the blowhole. Using the booties as maintenance instead of prevention worked for my dogs where it would not maybe work for a racing dog.
Speaking of booties, you spent less than a $20 bill.
Yes.
For dog booties, even though you probably had 1,000.
Yes, I had 1,000.
But you literally spent less than a $20 bill.
And again, you know, we came prepared for every eventuality. I spent $2,000 on dog coats. We had 3 caches of supplies along the way, and there was extra dog booties in everyone. I never experienced the conditions we were going to be up against monitoring the feet. And I think the reason why it's in increments of 8 is I think out of 16 dogs, I had 8 paws that got sore over the course of the expedition.
Gear question, but it's sort of related to safety, Jonathan. So let's make this a 2-parter. What safety measures did you take to prepare for extreme weather conditions? And I always ask this question to non-Alaskan mushers, because I always tell people that you cannot buy Alaskan gear outside. Mm-hmm. We call it outside when you travel outside of Alaska. I always tell people, either wait till you get here or figure out what we're wearing up here and then buy that ahead of time. So let's talk about gear and let's talk about safety. So what safety measures did you take to prepare for extreme weather? We already talked about the dogs with the booties and the coats and all of that. Let's talk about people.
Yeah. You know, obviously we even did a team class on using our GPSs, and we had an in-reach satellite that we could set up whenever we wanted to, not in-reach satellite, Starlink mini satellite. So once a day we hooked up and communicated with the outside world. So that was safety. As far as gear is concerned, it's really interesting. We had polar explorer Eric Larson do a weekend, you know, Arctic 101 class with us. And, you know, this isn't my first rodeo. I was cold weather infantry in the Marine Corps, and, I've been to Alaska and I've mushed for 30 years. So I know a little bit, and I knew enough to know that, like, his gear was exactly what is needed for someone skiing across Antarctica to the South Pole. But it is not at all, even, you know, as closely related as it seems like it would be, not at all the gear that champion mushers use on the trail. And, you know, as you know, there's a few outfitters that create gear specifically designed for mushers. No matter which one you choose, there's going to be naysayers and detractors, you know, saying, oh, you know, don't use that one because of this or that. I use Heyes Adventure gear for my bibs and for the anoraks. Every member of the team had a Heyes Adventure gear anorak. My feeling is that it's exceptional gear. My feeling is that, I hear people that, you know, say, you know, it's got breathability issues and your sweat gets trapped in it. But this is what I know. Twice I've been completely submerged in Heyes Adventure gear, anorak, and bibs.
And for folks listening, that was episode one. Yes, episode one of this story. So you're talking about the Heyes gear.
Yeah. And, you know, both times the Heyes gear completely like froze up like a suit of armor. But both times, and this sounds crazy, both times I almost felt warmer after that froze up, almost like it had created a bubble around me that was actually retaining my heat inside a little bit better. I've got nothing but good to say about Heyes Adventure gear. I love their stuff. I haven't experienced some of the, you know, the drawbacks that other people have said that they've had with it. Not to say it doesn't exist, just it's not been in my experience.
So let's come back to safety in a second. Was there one piece of gear, whether it's human gear, clothing, whichever, that you're swearing by now? And yes. Is there something you probably would, this is three parts, something you swear by,
yes.
Something that you're cursing,
yes.
That you did not like, whatever yes. gear, and is something that you knew you wish you would have had, whether it's dog, tech, sled, something. So it's a three-parter.
So again, this comes back to, we had this, you know, Expedition 101 with polar explorer Eric Larson, and I want to be teachable. So I'm trying to absorb as much information as I can. But Antarctica and crossing interior Alaska, you know, it's not the same thing. And one of the decisions that I made based on that training was, and I'm sorry, I love this company. Please don't get mad at me. Do you want me to say the name of the company?
Sure.
Okay. So, Wintergreen Extreme Expedition Mittens. I was going to go with those or traditional Beavermans. And, you know, all of my traditionalist friends, and I'm a very traditionalist person by nature, were saying, go with the Beaver, go with the Beaver. And all of my, you know, techie friends, including, you know, our Polar Explorer friends, said, you know, go with Wintergreen Extreme, you know, Expedition Mittens. So that's what I did. I went with Wintergreen Extreme Expedition Mittens. They're okay until they're not. When they're not, they're really not. And if there's any moisture involved and then they freeze back up, they're almost completely unusable. It's really difficult to get your hands in. And a couple of my teammates took my advice and got Beaver mittens, Jamie being one of them. And where I lost some skin on my fingers and had some pretty good frostbite on my hands, Jamie's hands, for the most part, came out unscathed, but he had to do a lot of mechanic work in extreme conditions, which meant exposed hands. But by the time we were halfway down the coast, I was drooling over his Beaver mittens and cursing my Expedition Extreme mittens.
So your gear that you wish you had. Beaver mittens.
Beaver mittens.
All right. And what about others, whether it be dog or sled or other tech? Is there something you wish you would have brought in hindsight?
Yeah.
What would that be?
So in the haste, again, I sing the praises of this expedition sled that was made for me locally here in Maine. But in the haste to have them put together, it came out with steel tips on the brake. And this is something so simple, something so small. And by day two of the expedition, there's so much ice that I'd worn through those tips. They should have been carbide tips, and I should have brought extra carbide tips. And every village we came into, I would tell the guys, I need some carbide tips. If we can find carbide tips, I need them for my brake, and I need them bad, especially as we got closer to the coast. They ended up replacing it with what they had, which was some screws, some flat bottom screws. And it actually made it worse because those flat bottom screws acted like the blades of ice skates once I hit the ice and gave me zero purchase at all on the coast. So carbide tips, man, bring some carbide tips with you because you never know when you're going to need some.
Safety. What did you do in terms of thinking about safety? I'm sure you guys had daily briefings, debriefings. What did you talk about when you would talk to your team and say, guys, we need to be safe about this X, Y, Z?
Yeah. There was a couple, and those, I told you there was a couple times where I had to, you know, use my veto power as the team leader. And those were the times where everyone just would get so focused on what they are doing. Like the cameraman gets so focused on what he's doing or recovering his lost drone that he ends up, you know, the search party has to go out for him because he got lost looking for a lost drone. Or Jamie being so determined to get his machines up and running in the middle of a gale force blizzard, that he misses the fact that he's starting to suffer frostbite and so are the team members because everyone's standing around. You know, at those moments, you know, you'd have to say, okay, guys, look, I understand your tunnel vision here, but, you know, for the sake of the team, you know, this is what's going to happen now.
Another two-parter, and this is the last question for this episode. And I bring this up because so many of our fans are fans of the movie Togo. And Togo has a big part of this story from lore. But of course, that's a Disney movie. So there is a lot of Disneyfication, I guess is the word for that. But how did you decide whether to cross Norton Sound or take the long way around? And what was that experience like? And then you have a quick story about coming into Unalakleet that you wanted to share.
Yeah. So I came in, obviously, I came into Unalakleet before, you know, before crossing Norton Sound. So I'll share that story. And then if we have time on this episode, I'll share the crossing, after Shaktulik, but, I'll let you decide based on the time. So the coast delivered on my anxieties. The moment I came down onto the river that feeds into the village of Unalakleet, everything was just glare ice. And as I just described it, I didn't have carbide tips on my brakes. The dogs, you know, we would pass a fish camp and we'd pass a cabin, and the dogs realized that we were already, this was a short run for them. It was mostly downhill. I think it was a 45-mile day or something. They realized we were already starting to get closer to town. And so they just started cranking up the speed, cranking up the speed. And, you know, we were all in this euphoria. And, you know, I would kind of try and check them and easy, guys, easy. And I was just really proud that, you know, here we are 2/3 of the way through the expedition. And these 16 dogs, you know, are, they've got juice, you know, they've got fuel in the tank. You know, they're starting to really shine here. And this is awesome. But as we started getting close to the village, we had to cross this big bay, you know, coming into Unalakleet, and it was all glare ice. And usually Jamie comes out, my team knows to follow his snow machine into town, and he leads us. Jamie didn't show up. He had fallen asleep on our host's couch. And so he wasn't there. And the cameraman sees a snowmobiler off in the distance. We can't tell if it's our guy. So the cameraman goes off looking for him. The dogs are trying, and I can't hold the team. They think I can, but I can't. And the dogs are just wanting to go. You know, they see the village. They know what that means. You know, it means straw. It means lots of, you know, fresh meat. And so then this other snowmobiler comes up, and it's my friend, Jeff Erickson, who lives in Unalakleet. And, you know, he says, follow me. And he just turns around to go back. He goes, Jamie fell asleep on my couch, so I figured I'd come out. I was like, well, thank you for coming out. He goes left. My cameraman's going right. And my lead dogs are like,
I know this guy. I don't know that guy. Right?
Yeah. So they took off after our cameraman. I was trying to say, whoa, 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 and I couldn't stop them. So I thought, well, instead of trying to stop them, I'm just going to try and course correct. So I would say haw, and they would turn, you know, 45 degrees to the left. And I'd say haw, and they'd turn 45 degrees to the left. But by this time, we were right on the edge of town. And Jeff Erickson's off my back left shoulder, and Caleb's off my back right shoulder, and the village is there. And the dogs are like, so they had plowed all of the snow from the village to this edge of town. And there was a mountain of snow and ice. And I had the GoPro on my head. And I was like, man, I'm just going to let the dogs do what they want to do. I'm like, okay.
How tall are we talking?
We're at least two stories, probably. Wow. 2 to 3. So, and I could tell once my team reached the top that there was something up there that was slowing them down, thank God. But when I got to the top, I realized what it was. There was crevasses in this big mountain of snow that were 4 to 6 feet deep. And I said, and it's on the GoPro, I was like, yep, this is where I lose my knee. And, you know, because I'm just teetering on these little ledges, you know, in these really deep crevasses, and the dogs are jumping from one to the other. And I just realized the only way I'm going to get down from this at all without breaking my leg is just balance my weight on the runners. If I try to touch the brake or touch anything, this is all over. So here I am getting pulled into Unalakleet. This town is an Iditarod town, used to seeing the best mushers in the world pull into town. And here I am being drugged into Unalakleet on my side.
It's the largest town on this entire trip.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a village. I mean, they have air service, they have restaurants, they have the whole nine.
And so when I finally convince my team to come to a stop, I have a little bit of a crowd watching me pull into town, because, you know, they were like, and I heard this the next day at the school, you know, 16 dog team pulling into town. Everyone was excited about it, and there was a buzz going on about it in the town. And man, how embarrassing. And just, you know, it was God has his ways of keeping me humble, and me, you know, sliding in the town on my butt, being drugged by 16 dogs is humbling, to say the least.
So we're going to save the Norton Sound crossing, since it's such a huge part of this story, not only for you, but obviously to the Sepala and Togo and all of that. But I have to ask, did you get a chance to have the pizza in Uniqlo?
We did. And I mentioned this earlier, you know, Uniqlo had just suffered a great tragedy. And our host, Donna Erickson, her nephew was one that had passed. So she had planned to do a traditional native meal for us. But, you know, she was obviously, you know, emotionally not in a position to be hosting us that night. And she was still a very gracious host, and I look forward to seeing them again. So we went out for pizza, and I ate that's one thing we learned about Jeff Kelly on our team. I don't know where he puts it, but Jeff literally, like, if we go to Subway, I get a foot long, he gets 2 footlongs and eats both of them. And we went to the pizza place in Uniqlo, and we each got a small pizza to ourselves. And he got, I think it was an extra large and a salad. We brought them some good business that night.
You know, for folks that are longtime listeners of the podcast, you know that this pizza place in Uniqlo, Peace on Earth Pizza, is a place of lore in Iditarod. You can order pizzas for Iditarod finishers or mushers, and they'll bring it out and all of that. And I usually don't make this podcast about me, but I've always said, and I've eaten pizza all over the country, all over the world, I will not eat that pizza unless I'm on a dog team.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of people have that.
That makes sense.
And at one point on the bucket list is to have the pizza by dog
team. We were hungry, and the downside was they do a lot of carry out. And we sat there for an hour and a half waiting for our pizzas. But boy, when it came out, it was worth it.
So to finish this up, Jonathan, we're about 500-ish miles or so, I guess, into the expedition from Nenana to Uniqlo. Where are we at in days? How far down on the calendar are we?
So we were I think we finished in 21 days, but it was 21 or 22 days, and it was 18 travel days.
Okay.
So probably 2/3 of the way through that at this point. So
a little longer than 2 weeks on the trail
at
this point. Was that right on schedule, or were we off one way or the other?
No, we were off because I had to do that reset of the team in Manly, and we were a couple days behind schedule. Every day that we traveled the number of miles we intended to, but it was the layovers. Like, you know, we'd get into the town too late to keep a promise to the school. So, you know, I'd have to, you know, spend extra time in that village the next day, that kind of thing.
All right, guys, we are more than halfway done with this series. We've made our way from Maine to Alaska overland. We've made it 2/3 of the way on the expedition. We still have a bunch of stories to tell in these upcoming episodes. Make sure you hit that subscribe button so you never miss these. Otherwise, Jonathan, I look forward to talking to you on the next one.
Yes, sir. Looking forward to it.
All right, thank you, guys. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.